Normally at the top of this show, we'd play our theme song. It's kind of jaunty, and I usually talk over it a little bit. Today, we're not doing that. Honestly, it just felt weird after a week of difficult news and emotional debate, plus a series of days when President Donald Trump was abandoned by corporate leaders over his response to the events in Charlottesville. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And a lot of our show today looks at life at work in this raw political moment. So we're going to start with what you do when work meets free speech and hate speech. If you looked at the photos or videos of the white nationalist rallies in Charlottesville, you could see exactly who was carrying torches, Nazi flags, and other white supremacist paraphernalia. And those images spread across the internet, making it relatively easy to identify people and track down where they work or go to school. Some people lost their jobs, others have not. And in a country where free speech is a cornerstone value, how do we deal with this? How should we? We brought in Kerry Fields. He's a business law and ethics professor at USC's Marshall School of Business. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How does the First Amendment apply to the workplace? And can your employer restrict your free speech? I guess that depends kind of on where you are, right?
It does. There is a balancing of interests, protection for free speech and rights of assembly, that people also have individual rights of privacy. But those are most often observed outside the workplace. Within the workplace, you don't have the ability to have a public forum and express any idea that you wish. It's constrained in the workplace.
So what does that mean if someone goes to an event like what we saw in Charlottesville, or let's say it's the other way around. Somebody goes to a pride march. Can that have repercussions on your workplace kind of position?
It can. We have to note that last week's group hatred exercise of bigotry and carrying weapons and shields and so forth went beyond a normal passive approach. Here, there were violent attacks and other things that related individual harming of individuals and a death. So this is going to cause a balance of the interest between the employee and their non-work hours and the employer's right to control the workplace, essentially obtaining efficiency and high morale among the employees and a public appreciation respect for the company's products and services. When you have an individual who poses such a concern for the employer, most states are going to consider the employee as an at-will employee, subject to only a handful of exceptions. Among them would be, does the employee have a contract? Does the reason for the termination offend public policy? Now, what's interesting in this particular case is that there are a number of states that protect the employees' off-hours political speech activities. 42 states protect these rights when the person is a public employee, so that a public employee might well exercise political free speech and not fear a dramatic disciplinary action at work. However, private employers may take a different approach because the First Amendment does not apply in its full scope in the private employment sector. So state laws and local laws would be the only remedy such an individual could look to protect their job status. So some of these employees that were involved in this activity might well be facing disciplinary or termination actions at their workplaces.
Is hate speech different? I mean, I used the passive example of going to a rally. That's one thing. But is, shouting bigoted, racist things, using violence or the threat of violence, is it different?
It can be, but we need to recognize that hate speech is not an exception to the First Amendment. As shocking as that may be, the First Amendment does protect hate speech. Now, when that hate speech combines with a crime, that is, a crime is committed on another person, or property is damaged because it's motivated by a person's bias, then it becomes a hate crime under state and federal law. But speech in itself, as distasteful as it may be, is still protected by the First Amendment.
So let's say you are an employee of a big company and, you know, you feel threatened by the fact that you saw your coworker on the television in Charlottesville, or, you know, make it a hypothetical, make it not Charlottesville, but somebody exercising hate speech. Is that a hostile workplace environment? Do you have the right to go to HR and say, gosh, I don't feel safe around this person?
I think in the typical case that would occur because you would say that there's a hostile work environment. Now, it's a fact-specific determination and creates a substantial morale problem for the employer because they have to attend to this immediately to ensure that the workforce remains safe, stable, and that their commitment to company values are maintained. There's a series of steps that the company could entertain in that situation. By itself, is it a hostile workplace? Technically, not yet, unless that individual brings that speech or behavior into the workplace. So if it's only in his or her off hours that this activity occurs, it's a harder case to make that it becomes a hostile workplace. But the company should take a series of steps to mitigate the harm that's going to undoubtedly infuse.
I mean, I'm thinking about this week, we have seen many major CEOs distance themselves from the president. And when you think about a big company, a lot of companies, though not all, have codes of conduct. Do you expect companies to kind of rework their policies or take a look at their employee policies in the wake of this and in the wake of public outcries and public attempts to dox people who were at these events?
I certainly do. I think it's incumbent upon all companies to revisit their statement of values, their mission statements, so that their core values of integrity, respect, and appreciation of diversity in the workplace are reinforced, that they're prominently restated by someone like a CEO to all employees and the company's vendors as well. They should block all hate groups from company communications systems, be a little more diligent in having the IT department scrub the ability of any employee to access them on any equipment. And concurrent with that, the companies need to review the state and local laws to see to what extent this free speech outside the workplace is perfectly protected. New York, California, and Washington, D.C. are such examples that employees may exercise their political expression without repercussion in the workplace. And that might be revisited by each of those jurisdictions in light of recent events.
Kerry Fields is a professor of business law and ethics at the USC Marshall School of Business. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace, we love to do the numbers. And here on The Weekend Show, we use them to put the events of the week in context. So with that, here are producers Tony Wagner and Sarah Menendez to bring us this week's news by the numbers. Tony, it's all yours.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
1 million.
That's how many tourists Oregon is expecting for the upcoming solar eclipse.
In some small towns, the population could temporarily increase tenfold.
That means lots of tourism dollars for local businesses, but it also raises some concerns. Chief among them are fire, traffic, and
lack of bathrooms. Ugh. The toilet issue has caused a rush for cities to rent out every possible porta potty for the occasion.
19 million.
That's how many dollars Costco owes Tiffany for selling generic rings using the Tiffany name.
Tiffany sued over Costco's language advertising the rings. The judge ruled they must be described as Tiffany style or with a Tiffany setting.
Even without the classic blue box, some customers were duped.
Costco is planning to appeal the ruling.
80,000.
That's how many dollars worth of chocolate went missing in Germany this week.
Thieves stole a refrigerated trailer packed with Nutella, Kinder eggs, and other treats.
Yum. European food theft is nothing new. 30 tons of fruit juice and 9 tons of garlic have gone missing in the past.
German police are still looking for the thieves, so be wary if someone tries to sell you large quantities of chocolate.
Yeah, do not take candy from strangers.
Here at Marketplace Weekend, no matter what's going on in the news, we want to hear your thoughts and comments on the stories that matter to you. Our show last week was dedicated to education, and we dug into a court case in Detroit over a constitutional right to literacy, which we're going to keep following. And you can read more on that at marketplace.org. We also talked about lunch shaming and changes in federal policy to put an end to the embarrassment children feel when they can't afford to pay for food. On Facebook, Kim Phillips wrote, "All students should be provided lunch without conditions. We don't expect students to pay for textbooks. The same should apply to meals." Well, in some places, who pays for what supplies is not so clear. We got an inside view on how teachers prepare for back to school and the money they spend on things for their classrooms. Miguel Castro asked, "How did this become a standard in public education?" Miguel, we are going to follow up on this. And on a lighter note, we shared some gift ideas for kids heading off to college. Nicholas DeCesar posted the comment, "I had a college professor who said that whenever a friend's child was going away to college, instead of, oh, the places you'll go, he'd gift them a People's History of the United States." But Al Lewis has another idea. "I got the perfect book, Oh, the Debts You Will Have." Keep your comments coming. You can email the team. We're weekend@marketplace.org. Follow Marketplace on Facebook. Just look for Marketplace Business News. Or you can call us. Our voicemail is 1-800-648-5114. Last week on the show, when my colleague Adrian Hill was sitting in, we focused on education. In general, kids in low-income neighborhoods tend to change schools more often than their better-off peers. That's according to studies from the Massachusetts Department of Education and Kids Count Rhode Island. And perhaps not surprisingly, moving around can have a detrimental effect on learning. So this past year, in Atlanta, one public school tried to break the trend by providing families with lawyers to fight evictions. Stephanie Stokes from WABE has more.
At Thomasville Heights Elementary in southeast Atlanta, kids are pouring into a cafeteria. They're shouting and playing, pretty typical stuff for an elementary school. But in an office just down the hall is a scene that's a lot less typical. There, Crystal Reynolds and Diana Jones-Lightsey are busy at work.
If you can today, call that repair line.
Reynolds is on the phone with a parent who needs her apartment windows replaced.
And please ask for a confirmation number.
Jones-Lightsey, meanwhile, reviews a stack of documents.
So all of this is the FOIA request.
They requested apartment building inspections through the Freedom of Information Act.
To go back and do comparisons. What they've claimed has been fixed and may not have been fixed, and what has actually been fixed.
The two are with a legal aid nonprofit called the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation. Their job is to keep kids at this school. Jones-Lightsey explains.
Last year, Thomasville Heights had a 40% turnover rate in their students. So that's almost half the students were coming in or going out in the course of the year.
The families were moving, and a lot of moving was happening in one place.
Thomasville Heights is unique in that right across the street, we have this huge subsidized housing apartment complex.
It's called Forest Cove. According to Jones-Lightsey and Reynolds, the complex has a bunch of problems.
Evictions, repairs not being made, issues like mold, rats, wood rot.
They say those problems make families leave. So Jones-Lightsey and Reynolds are using the tools of the legal system.
We work with 7 of the top firms in Atlanta. Their focus is on how do we help these residents stay here and help improve conditions.
Attorneys send demand letters or even go to court, all pro bono. And in cases like Legina Brown's, it's worked. I meet her at the income-based apartments where she lives with her 6 kids.
It's comfortable for me because, say, I have to quit my job for some reason, I don't have to worry about being thrown out.
Last year, though, she had some trouble. Her air conditioning went out upstairs, and electricity stopped working downstairs. Then she found bed bugs.
And it was just a horrible process because, like, we really didn't have nowhere to go. The house, to me, was not livable. So, basically, we were just sleeping wherever we could.
She says the apartment manager sent her an eviction notice, arguing the bed bugs were her fault. And that's when the volunteer lawyer stepped in. One fought her eviction in court. And later, after she won and repairs still weren't complete, another lawyer followed up.
I don't know what he wrote, but after the lawyer sent the letter, they got it done the very next day, immediately.
The attorney's help kept Brown at Forest Cove and three of her kids at Thomasville Heights Elementary. And that stability is what the school wants, says Principal Nicole Jones.
Kids don't learn from people who they don't like or know very well. So it's really important that we get them here and they stay.
A recent New York University study found the less students change schools, the better they focus and perform on tests. Jones says the women with the Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation are also familiar now at Thomasville Heights.
They're very trusted. The parents don't think anything about it. It's just like, can I talk to the teacher or can I see the principal? You know, can I talk to the lawyer?
A spokesperson for the Forest Cove apartment owner says they've spent $3 million on renovations in the last 3 years, and they're now selling the property to another company, promising more repairs. Still, Jones-Lightsey and Reynolds say they plan to stay at the elementary school.
I think it's important that management feels like all the tenants at Forest Cove now have a lawyer, so we'll be around.
The Atlanta Volunteer Lawyers Foundation program is also expanding. This year, lawyers start working with five more schools with high student turnover rates. In Atlanta, I'm Stephanie Stokes for Marketplace.
We're going to stay with education now. A lot of kids and families are going back to school and doing that shopping. And you heard that comment earlier. Last week, we talked about how much that costs parents and teachers every year. One listener, a teacher himself, brought up a good question about how taxes or tax holidays play a role in back-to-school spending.
Hello, my name is Andrew Green. I live in Washington, D.C., and for 10 years, I've been a high school music teacher in D.C. public schools. Maryland has a tax-free weekend for school supplies around this time of year. My mother, who grew up in Maryland, said that she remembered driving out to Delaware to buy school supplies because they have no sales tax. Are there other intersections between taxes and back to school around the rest of the country? Are they meant to take the strain off teachers and families, or are they meant to promote spending?
It turns out at least 16 states have sales tax holidays for the back to school season this year. And to answer some of Andrew's questions, we called Meg Weehy. She's the deputy director of the Nonpartisan Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get a sense of what the purpose of these sales tax holidays actually is. I mean, is this to relieve the burden on parents and teachers? Is it to boost spending? Like, what's the point?
That's an excellent question. I think that the point has been lost over the years since these sales tax holidays were first put into place. The simple explanation is that they are a break, a 2 to 3 day break from paying sales taxes on a set of items.
And who does this benefit?
Ultimately, I really think that it benefits lawmakers more than anyone. Hmm. Some would suggest that this benefits retailers because you have a lot of people in stores on the weekends of the holidays. But in truth, you know, research has found that's not the case. There is no real boost to retail sales simply because people need to buy these back to school supplies, and they just shift the timing of when they make those purchases to when the holiday is happening. The taxpayers themselves, those getting the break, not really the winners either, for a number of reasons.
Yeah, why not?
Well, for starters, in most of these states, let's take Alabama, for example. I looked at a list of back-to-school supplies that a family would have to purchase for a student at a school in Alabama. 4 boxes of crayons, a roll of paper towels, a box of storage bags. You know, the list sort of goes on. Altogether, that totaled to be about $35 that the family would have to pay for one student, for a whopping savings of $1.36. I think what it really begs the question of is why are families being asked to, families and teachers, by the way, to purchase classroom supplies in the first place? In reality, that family would save $34 if state lawmakers instead provided adequate revenues and funding for K-12 education, including classroom supplies.
Well, yeah, I mean, this gets to sort of larger questions of policy, tax policy writ more broadly behind all of this. I mean, state tax systems, as you have noted and studied, tend to take a decent chunk proportionally from working families' budgets. And I guess I'm curious, would a sales tax holiday give them a reprieve, or does it just not make enough of a difference when you look at somebody's bottom line?
Exactly. I mean, most of the states on the list of the 16 that have sales tax holidays have a very high reliance on sales taxes the other 362 or 363 days of the year. So while this family in Alabama may save on the holiday weekend, they're still every other day of the year paying a much larger share of their income in state and local taxes than those at the higher end of the income spectrum. And that's not just a problem for, you know, in the eyes of fairness of who should be paying, but it also leads to inadequate revenues over the long term.
One of the conversations that we've been having among our staff, I'm sort of searching back in my memory, and I could be wrong because I was a kid, but I don't remember parents and teachers paying for things like copy paper when I was in, you know, first and second grade. Have we seen a change over the past few decades in the way budgets are formulated and what parents and teachers are asked to float?
Absolutely. But what's really happened over the years in a number of states, and particularly some of the states on this list that offer sales tax holidays, is there's less and less of an investment in public education. And one then convenient way to make up for some of the lack of cash to go into our K-12 spending is to ask teachers and parents to pay for classroom supplies. I have a child in public school. And when I look at the list, I think this is so nonsensical for each family of each of the 20 families in my kid's classroom to buy these supplies rather than the school system, you know, purchasing them in bulk, right? I mean, I'm buying an individual roll of paper towels. I'm buying an individual box of tissue paper. It seems so inefficient.
So when I listen to all of this, I guess I wonder, why do these things exist at all?
I think that they're very popular political gimmicks that give lawmakers a lot of great publicity. The truth is that the cost to the state, the lost revenue, is not that great. You know, I used Alabama as an example before. The state holiday there will cost around $9 million, which is well less than 1% of state revenue collections in the state. If you're a lawmaker, you get, think about all that, you get all this free advertising, retailers are doing all of that work for you, and it looks like you're doing something great for your constituents. While it's a distraction from the bigger picture problem with these states upside down and inadequate tax structures.
Meg Wehe, Deputy Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Livelihood doesn't depend on it, you might not have been focused on NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, this week. After 23 years, the trade deal between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico is being renegotiated. Or rather, those talks have started. A lot of people are watching those meetings closely, like all the local businesses that operate on our borders. First up, let's go south.
My name is Deanna Williams-Heffley. I'm the owner of The Desert Gypsy, which is a small retail store in El Paso, Texas.
The Desert Gypsy sells handcrafted objects made in Mexico and sold in Texas. So clearly, NAFTA and changing trade relations with Mexico are really important to Williams-Heffley.
The part that concerns me, of course, are the tariffs that might be imposed if a tax of 20 to 35% were added to the merchandise that I cross. That would basically put me out of business.
She's talking about the suggested border tax with Mexico, which has many people along that border worried. Williams-Heffley is sort of hoping a lot of what NAFTA offered 23 years ago stays the same.
I'm still optimistic that small businesses will not be affected. During the presidential campaign, I know that President Trump threatened to completely do away with NAFTA trade agreement. From what I'm hearing now, these current talks with Mexico and Canada are intended to revamp the trade agreement somehow rather than abolish it.
Trump did indeed promise to get rid of it if he couldn't renegotiate better terms. So far, the three parties are not exactly seeing eye to eye in these talks. Let's turn now to our northern border.
My name's David Bruce, and I'm the CFO with Vaughan Brothers. We've been around since 1972 here in Colville.
Colville is in the state of Washington, and Vaughan Brothers is a lumber company with sawmills in both the U.S. and Canada. Lumber is not included in NAFTA itself. It's governed by different trade rules, but Bruce will still be watching what happens because lumber could be used as leverage in the NAFTA talks.
Dairy and some of the ag-related items have been kind of lumped in with lumber. You know, we kind of were hoping that everything would stay separate. Typically, it's always been held outside of NAFTA, so I would have hoped that we'd be a little further along by the time NAFTA started its negotiations, just so it couldn't get brought into the discussions in the room, but I guess we'll see.
Bruce says Canada has more at stake in the success of its lumber exports than the U.S.
Canadian imports into the U.S. typically make up anywhere from 30 to 35% of the supply for the U.S. market. And the U.S. has always argued that the Canadians subsidize their raw materials based on the way they sell their timber to industry. So that's been looked at as unfair, either through anti-dumping on the lumber side for selling it cheaply because they have a cheaper raw material, and as well on the countervailing duty side.
Mexico will host the second round of NAFTA negotiations in September. Speaking of NAFTA, if it all seems complicated, we have a great video of Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explaining it all, and you can find it at marketplace.org. Our reporters are always busy here at Marketplace, so here's a little preview of a story reporter Aaron Schrank is working on.
So gentrification is a hot-button issue in Los Angeles right now. House prices are really high and going higher. That means people who want to rent or buy somewhere affordable are moving into working-class, usually Latino neighborhoods. It's become a real big problem in East L.A. People like to say that this is inevitable, but I spoke with some activists who are doing something that challenges that idea. They've been running a community organizing space in a rented storefront for years, but a strip mall developer recently came in and tried to buy the place for more than $1 million. So they confronted the guy.
We asked him if he was conscious of, you know, that he was going to be destroying a whole lot and that he was going to be doing it to make profits.
They kind of told him they weren't going to go quietly, so he went off to think about it, and then
he came back and said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you guys 10 days to come up with a bona fide offer. But if you don't come up with a bona fide offer, then I am going to buy it, and I don't want you guys chasing me around.
To own the building, they needed a down payment of at least $180,000. These organizers don't have that kind of money lying around, so they thought, hey, let's get the community to own this building. They put the word out, and some money started coming in. Did they make their deadline? Well, you'll have to listen to the story to find out.
That and more on Marketplace next week. Earlier on the show, we talked about free speech and the workplace. Now we're going to dig deeper into diversity at work. Earlier this month, we had this.
Reports of a controversial memo circulating within Google began appearing on social media. The full memo, titled Google's Ideological Echo Chamber, is published by Gizmodo. In it, now former Google engineer James Damore.
The employee claimed women were not biologically fit for tech jobs because they show higher interest in people over things, are too cooperative, are more prone to anxiety.
He also went on to say that men have a higher drive for status that
Google has fired the employee behind an internal company memo that alleges huge gaps in representation between men and women in the tech industry are due to biological differences.
But what if we told you that greater diversity is linked to better business outcomes? That's where Catherine Phillips from Columbia Business School comes in. She says a more diverse workforce is like any investment a company makes and has to become part of its strategic plan. Catherine Phillips, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
You know, when something like the Google memo happens and this sort of controversy surfaces, you are the go-to voice. And I want you, for our listeners, to lay out your kind of groundbreaking research from 2010, Better Decisions Through Diversity. What did you find?
So I've done research looking at diverse decision-making teams and comparing them to homogeneous teams. And what I've discovered is that when you have a group that has some social diversity present, everyone knows that there are some differences between the individuals in the room, they are more likely to share their information, that unique information that's in their heads, and they're more likely to get the right answer than the homogeneous groups, the groups where everyone in the room thinks that they're the same, they're from the same social group.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that was really striking about that research is that when you ask people after they have gone through this group discussion and they've made their decision about what they think the right answer is, the homogeneous groups consistently say that they were more effective, that they were are more confident that they have the right answer, despite the fact that the objective data tells us the complete opposite, that the diverse groups performed more effectively.
In other words, it's good for the bottom line, but it makes people feel uncomfortable sometimes in the process?
Exactly. The way that I like to think of it is kind of with an analogy of kind of pain and gain. You know, you go to the gym, and when you go to the gym, you work out, and you're looking for a little bit of twinge in your muscle, a little bit of pain to actually make sure that you're getting some benefits from going to the gym. It's the same thing with diversity. When you go into a room with people who look like, you know, who are different from yourself, who you assume may have some different perspectives than you do, you have to engage with them, and that might be uncomfortable at times.
Do you think your research helps explain why companies in the tech sector, or even, frankly, in the media sector, talk a good game when it comes to diverse hiring practices or mentoring young people, but then when you look at who's in the top rung or when you look at who's on the masthead, doesn't actually look that different from who was there 15 years ago?
Yeah. For a long time, we have been trying to make sure that the leadership of organizations understand the value of diversity. But the people who are the middle managers, right, who are doing the work every day, who are making the decisions about who should be hired and who shouldn't, and what work people have an opportunity to be involved in, they're all kind of grappling with this discomfort that they're constantly feeling. They watch the diverse groups interact and they see that, you know, they're actually having some conflict. They're not agreeing with each other. It's not so smooth. And they want to avoid that. So you end up with the biases and the concerns about diversity really showing up in the day-to-day decision-making that's being made by the people who are on the ground.
So let's flip this around a little bit. Let's take this, you know, memo from Google. I'm pretty sure we could argue that James Damore did not expect this to blow up in the way that it did. It sparked a lot of uncomfortable conversations. What are the merits in, say, keeping someone who has a viewpoint that is offensive to other colleagues and talking about it and learning from it? And what are the merits to saying, yeah, that's not welcome here. Goodbye.
Certainly, as I've said, social diversity is really important. And it's very important to recognize that people will have different viewpoints, different perspectives, and that those should be embraced, right, in some real meaningful ways. But there's also something about culture and values that have to be espoused very clearly by organizations when they bring that diversity in. And it actually turns out that a lot of diversity and values and what it is that we're really trying to accomplish here is not that beneficial for the organization. It's always a fine line because there's that question of fit, right? The organizational fit, which oftentimes has been used to keep people who look like me out of organizations. They don't fit.
That's a code word.
Yeah, it's code word. And it's like, well, what does that really mean? They don't fit here. They don't look the part. That's very different than they have values that are inconsistent with the values of this organization.
There's something you said to my producer that I found really fascinating. With to many hiring managers, and often white ones, diversity means someone like me but brown. And that just doesn't exist. You can't have a carbon copy of yourself. People are different and have different life experiences. So when you think about this word, diversity, what does it mean?
I oftentimes start off, you know, kind of diversity conversations with companies with that very question. What is your definition of diversity? And I ask everyone in the room to write down what they think it is. Like, what is it? The reality is that diversity is what in that given context people are using to tell themselves this person is different from me in this meaningful way. You know, there is some diversity in the way people think about the concept itself, but I have always used it in my own research, defined it as whatever it is that people are using to tell themselves that this person is different from me. And not only are they different from me, but now I'm assuming things about them. I'm assuming that they think differently than I do. I'm assuming that they are, you know, sometimes not as good as I am.
What do you do if some employees are not on board and they make that known?
People have said, oh, we've been talking about diversity for so long. And I've said to them, actually, I've been talking about diversity. And this other person over here has been talking about diversity. But there's a lot of people who have not been in this conversation. And so I think we're at the point now where the topic of diversity has become one where everybody realizes, wait a minute, I need to maybe pay attention to this a little bit more and understand it a little bit more and have a perspective on it. I think a lot of people have just skated along for a very long time. And now we have, a very large coalition of people who are starting to have an impact with this perspective, and we're going to get resistance. There will be people pushing back. And I think what we see right now is a lot of resistance coming up from people who have been paying attention. They've been quietly paying attention, and now they're ready to push back. And we have to keep our message on point and keep pushing forward.
Well, so let's say someone who runs a company is listening to this and says, well, yeah, that sounds good, but even watching all of this fighting and hatred, this is too scary for me. I don't even want to engage in this conversation because it might blow up around my employees and I'm not comfortable with that. What do you say to them?
The role of leaders, the job of leadership, is one that oftentimes calls for people to take stances that could potentially, you know, have some people not want to follow you, and being compelling about those perspectives. The people that you might upset, perhaps you don't want them following you in the first place.
Catherine Phillips is a professor of leadership and ethics at Columbia Business School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For a longer version of our conversation with Professor Phillips, you can check out our website, marketplace.org. Staying with work, we've now got Allison Green. She runs the blog Ask a Manager and is our regular guest every month to talk about all things jobs related. Last month, it was about what to wear and not to wear at work. This time around, the do's and don'ts of kids at the office. Allison, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I'm going to turn to our topic this month, which is kids in the office. Work environments are changing. You know, mores and rules are changing. When is it okay to bring your kid to work?
It really depends on your office culture. I mean, there are some offices where it would never be okay to do it. There's some where it's okay if it's an emergency, but you don't do it often. And there's even some where people are pretty laid back about it happening more often than that. So you've got to have a good feel for your office's particular culture, which is so often the case about these workplace questions.
Right.
But I will say if it's okay to do it in your office, it's really important to be thoughtful about how to do it appropriately, how to minimize the impact on your coworkers. So making sure that your kid doesn't make a ton of noise and isn't racing through the halls and rifling through papers and has something to occupy them and keep them busy if they're older than a baby. I hear from a lot of readers who get frustrated when parents bring kids into work and then don't pay attention to those things, and it ends up interfering and being a disruption. So you just, if it is okay in your office, you just want to watch out for those things.
I want to play you a question from one of our listeners, Christina Mayer. Let's play that audio.
My son is 7 months old. While on maternity leave, I brought him to meet my manager and coworkers. Since then, several coworkers in other departments have asked me repeatedly to bring my son back to work so they can enjoy, quote, baby time. We're allowed to work from home, so some days I come in and leave after morning meetings. My question is it okay to bring my crawling but otherwise laid-back baby for an hour once or twice a year? What's the etiquette for babies at work?
All right, Allison, hit it. What's the etiquette?
I think an hour once or twice a year is going to be fine in most offices, especially if your coworkers are clamoring to see your baby.
Right.
I think the danger is – when people take it a little too far, where they hear that enthusiasm and so the kid starts coming in all the time. And then you get people who maybe aren't as okay with it, but feel awkward about saying something. So I think just be careful to keep it to once or twice a year. Be careful about noise. Don't stick the baby with someone else to babysit while you go to a meeting. Even if someone else seems happy to do it, it can become a problem if a work thing comes up that they need to handle. And be attuned to signals from coworkers who maybe aren't baby people. But otherwise, I think she's on pretty solid ground here.
Switching a little bit to a different perspective, I mean, there is a liability and safety issue here. What do employers have to think about? Do they have to consider liability?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they often do think about liability in most offices, but they would be smart to. There are all kinds of things kids can get into trouble with if you're not watching them in an office. I mean, you don't want your kid playing with the industrial-sized paper shredder, although I'm sure that would be great fun for them. I think one thing that I see come up more than safety issues like that is germs, that parents will sometimes bring a sick kid to work because it can be tough to get childcare when your kid is sick. You want to be careful about doing that if they're contagious. I had a letter earlier this year from a reader whose coworker brought her sick kid to work because daycare wouldn't take him when he was ill and ended up spreading norovirus throughout the whole office, including to someone who was immune compromised. So people were not pleased. So you want to tread really carefully there when germs are in play.
You know, this conversation raised some really interesting comments on our Facebook page and around really what some people saw as inequality of workloads for people with kids and without. I want to read you a little bit of a comment from Rachel Sennett. She says, as a child-free woman myself, I can tell you with certainty that employers take our child-free status for granted. I have never and will never cost my employer even one day of maternity leave, additional insurance cost, calling out with a sick child, leaving work to attend school events, etc. I'm dependable always unless there is a huge emergency. But it seems like the child-free among us are always somehow picking up the slack for parents when duty calls, even though it has nothing to do with us. So put a pin in that, and then I'm going to read the flip side, and we can get into this. To which this comment, Erin Rainey responded, quote, if you get in a car accident or whatever and have to leave your job for an extended period of time, guess who will pick up the slack for you? Your coworkers with kids. Being a parent isn't some magical get-out-of-work-free card. When I have a, quote, sick day, I'm still working, but with my kid. Before I had kids, I happily covered for my coworkers who had family obligations because everyone deserves a life outside of work, whether that is time spent on kids or hobbies or significant others or friends. So this is a really thorny one, Allison. People get into this. Does Rachel have a point? Do companies kind of expect child-free workers to, you know, carry some weight here? Or what do you think?
Sometimes, yeah, I think they do. I hear from a lot of child-free people who are frustrated that their employers don't give them the same flexibility that they give parents. Everyone understands a parent needing to leave to pick up a child from daycare, but non-parents will often have a tougher time if they want to leave early to take a class or play in a volleyball league or whatever it might be. Ideally, employers would find ways to be flexible with everyone, not just people with kids. But in reality, the way it plays out, the needs of people with kids often end up taking priority.
So, I mean, is there something employers can do to kind of deal with how raw that issue gets or kind of address that feeling of inequity?
So I think what managers need to do is keep an eye on how this stuff is playing out over time and make sure that whatever flexibility they're offering is distributed evenly over a period of time. Maybe it's not distributed evenly tonight when people have to stay late for a deadline, but over the course of a month or a quarter, you want to make sure that it's evening out.
Okay, we have covered kids. We are going to mention another family member, and I know I'm going to get a hard time for this, fur babies. This is a question from Brian Rivera. A few months back, I started to bring my pup to the office, a Greyhound former racer. He's potty trained, haven't had any issues outside a few people slipping him snacks. What should I be doing to be a bit more proactive on making sure he doesn't overstay his welcome? I have a dog. I am biased in favor of dogs. I have not brought her here, but is it okay to bring your pet to the office? And, you know, let's help Brian out. I'd be like, how do you make it still okay?
So in some offices, it is okay. It's sort of like the thing with kids. You've got to know your own office. it can be tricky because you have to factor in people who have allergies or people who maybe just aren't comfortable around dogs. But if you're in an office where those aren't issues and your dog is well-behaved and welcomed by your coworkers, a lot of people will consider it a real benefit. Even the people who aren't bringing the dog in will consider it a real benefit to get to interact with the dog during the day. You've just got to be gracious about it if the situation ever changes. If your office hires someone who turns out to have serious allergies and your dog can't come in anymore, you don't want that person to be the target of everyone's resentment for ruining the good time with the dog. I had a letter a couple of years ago from someone who was highly allergic to dogs. Got a job in an office where a lot of people brought their dogs to work, and then faced a ton of hostility from everyone for being the cause of the dog policy ending. And it was bad enough that she ended up
like the downer.
Yeah, she killed all the dog fun. So she ended up leaving over it because people were so hostile to her about it. So you don't want to be the cause of a situation like that. So if you can bring your dog to work, enjoy it while you can. Just know that it might not be forever because your staffing might change and someone might come in where it doesn't work for them.
I'm going to repeat all of this tomorrow when I get home and talk to her and give her dinner. Allison Green writes the workplace blog Ask a Manager. She joins us every month to answer your questions. If you've got a work issue you need help with, office relationships, how to revamp your resume, the tricky question of whether you should microwave fish, never, ever. You can email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org. And you can listen to more of Allison's advice by going to our website, marketplace.org. Allison Green, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Marketplace Weekend for this week. The show is produced by Eliza Mills and Paulina Velasco. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.